The biggest problem that people find is that they say, well, I'm going to write a blog post or do a video or send up a smoke signal or whatever when I feel like I have something interesting to say. And that, my friends, is the kiss of death.
Right.
If that is how you think about content, you will never be good at this.
All right, it's time for another brand new episode of our show. But today we are launching a new name for our show. And not only do we have a new name, we've got an amazing special guest who I'm going to let tell you our name in just a minute. You're going to hear about an investment you can make in your business that pays off geometrically over time. You're going to hear something really fascinating about bricks and feathers and a whole lot more. You're in for a great one today. Here's our guest.
Hi, this is Jay Baer, and you are listening to the Grow the Dream podcast.
Oftentimes, it's the ones that are successful loved what they did so they could persevere when, you know, when it got really tough. And the ones that didn't love it quit.
I learned many great lessons from my father, not the least of which was that you can fail at what you don't want. So you might as well take a chance on doing what you love.
Welcome to the most indispensable show for people doing the hard work of growing your business. It's the marketing podcast by entrepreneurs for entrepreneurs. Welcome to Grow the Dream.
All right, welcome to the Grow the Dream Show, episode 12. One of the ones I've been looking forward to the very most. You're going to find out why shortly. In fact, if you get ready to take notes, you will thank me for it later. My name is David Johnson. Glad you're listening.
And my good friend, Rod Thompson, as always.
Love being here, as always.
Good morning, messaging guru, 30-year veteran journalist. Has changed sides now, working for the other side. And my other good friend, Josh Mucci.
What are you going to call me today?
I'm going to call you the kid because I think it's sticking.
Stick with the kid.
The kid. The kid. The tech whiz. The entrepreneurial guru. Well, we call you that just because you've already sold your first company, so, you know.
But I feel privileged to be in a room with you all.
Oh, well, that's...
I've always liked you, Josh.
Nice of you. And the brew of the day, we are sipping on some kosher from Left Roasters. This is originating in Ethiopia. What do you think, Rod?
A little too smooth for me.
A little too smooth. It's a little acidic. It's got a little lemon note in it.
Yeah, Rodney's going to have his tar.
I like it strong. I like it active.
But more importantly, today... Gentlemen,
yes.
We have with us an amazing special guest. We have the founder of Convince and Convert, celebrated marketing speaker, best-selling author, Jay Baer. Jay, how are you this morning?
I am fantastic. I was hoping the special guest would be Juan Valdez.
Well, Juan's not from Ethiopia, so he doesn't fit with today's brew of the day. So
it's true. That's true.
Next week.
That's true. But he knows those people. They all, it's a small community, really.
It's a cartel. Is that what you're trying to say?
I didn't say that.
Okay. All right. Yeah. We wouldn't want to admit to that in public.
No.
So, Jay, I'm, first of all, thank you very much for taking the time to be here. I know
my pleasure.
Yeah, you have a busy schedule. You are also the host of Social Pros, and something I realized this morning that I didn't realize you were doing prior to that is the you've actually taken the Convince and Convert blog, and you're podcasting with it. How's that going?
Yeah, it's funny you say that. The Convince and Convert podcast, which is our best blog posts read by yours truly, as well as by professional voice talent. Launches today. So I can't tell you how it's going because it's literally been live for like 20 minutes. So you're the first person other than people who work on our team to ever even notice or comment on it. In fact, the blog post to announce it is being written by me today. So I will get back to you.
How did you know about it?
I tell you what, man, guys, I can't take any like special credit. I opened Stitcher this morning and I was going to listen to one episode of Social Pros on the way. To the show this morning, and I dialed, you know, Stitcher up with, I just searched Jay Baer just to see what would come up, and I thought, well, maybe he's been a guest on somebody else's podcast or something lately, and I saw Convince and Convert, and I went, wait a minute, is there a whole podcast I didn't know about?
Wow. And there's also Jay Today, which I love listening to. That 3 minutes, holds up his three fingers there every time, does his 3 minutes.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's actually, that's a great little thing.
And Content Pros is the other show that we produce, which is similar to the Social Pros podcast, but for people who are content marketing professionals, and my team produces that show, and the host of that show is Chris Moody from Oracle.
Yeah, excellent. And that was just launched in January, somewhere there?
Yeah, it's recently. Going great. They do They do a nice job with that show. They've had some great guests.
So, Jay, with content marketing, you know, as you know, our listeners are primarily small business owners and their teams. I say small, you know, under 500 employees is how the SBA defines that. But no, really, seriously, companies that don't have dedicated marketing staff. And so a lot of folks in that space are still sort of kind of waking up to the idea of content marketing. You were really kind of ahead of the idea of content marketing when you launched Convince and Convert. When did you get started with Convince and Convert?
I've been in digital marketing since 1993, so for a long, long time. Convince and Convert was launched in 2008, and it started off just as my blog. Like other people have a blog, right? I'm a consultant, and I'm going to write about what I know, and so I wrote you know, 4 blog posts a week for a year or two, and then eventually it became a thing, and then we very wisely, I think, pivoted from being Jay's blog to being a full-fledged sort of digital education and media company where, you know, now we do, so we used to do 4 blog posts a week and I wrote them all, and now we do 10 blog posts a week and I write one of them. And from an ego standpoint, you would hope that, well, now that I don't write very much, I'm sure nobody cares. But of course, traffic is up like 600% since I stopped writing so much of the blog.
So much for ego. Yes.
There you go. Yeah.
Oh, so the blog is certainly well known. I read it constantly, and I'm not sure. So let's talk about who your audience is typically when you're writing the content for Convince and Convert. Who are you really targeting?
We have 3 personas at Convince and Convert, at least on the blog side. The first and probably the largest are digital marketing professionals. So these are people whose occupation is digital marketing, social media marketing, content marketing. And so they might be a director, a manager, a coordinator, a VP of those kind of things at a company. Second audience are small business owners. And the third audience are enterprise marketers who are doing those same kind of social media content marketing, digital marketing jobs, but for very, very large companies all around the world. Our podcast audience, the Social Pros audience, tends to serve that third group more so than the blog, because the guests that we have on the Social Pros podcast are almost exclusively large companies. And so it's kind of a podcast for that group. So that limits the size of the podcast audience a little bit, but that's okay because we're trying to serve a very specific community.
Jay, I'm curious about this in a kind of a broad 30,000 foot level. Philosophically, from your point of view, is there a difference in approach in marketing for small businesses and large companies, obviously beyond resources and staff and that sort of thing? Or should the approaches actually be quite similar?
You could write a whole book on that question.
Are you working on that book, Jay? No.
No, I'm not, but that's an interesting idea. I might be now.
Well, it might make a difference whether it's consumer-focused or business-to-business enterprise.
That in particular, I don't feel has much of a difference. I've written a lot about the B2B versus B2C conundrum, and B2B people invariably are like, hey, that's really great, but that's not a B2B example, therefore it doesn't apply to us, which is like the biggest load of horse crap ever. As if B2B customers, the B2B customers have some sort of totally different psychology.
They're not people,
right? Their genetic structure is different.
Everybody is B2C before they're B2B.
And right.
So I think whether it's small business, large business, government, business to business, business to consumer, the fundamentals are all the same, right? You're a business, you have customers, you have prospective customers. They either want to be informed or entertained by you. You have a story to tell, you should tell that story. All of the big picture ingredients of the recipe is totally the same. The difference is whether you're using cayenne pepper or ancho pepper, right? It's the difference is in the details at the margin. The core is the same. And I think we spend too much time worrying about those differences and not enough time talking about the similarities.
Excellent.
So the personas that you described earlier when you're writing the Convince and Convert blog, do you assign different writers to the different personas, or are the how does that play out in sort of a practical way?
That's a great question. It's not quite that organized yet. We have a terrific managing editor, Jess Ostroff, who coordinates all of our guest contributors, of which, you know, in a given year, we might have 125, 150 different people writing on the blog.
Wow.
So it's quite a crew. And so to achieve some measure of tonal consistency is a trick. So while we don't necessarily assign personas at a particular post level, what we do is work with our contributors to say, our goal as a blog is, generally speaking, to write about things that you're not going to find on other blogs, right? We're not Mashable. We're not a news blog. We're not trying to tell you, here's what's happening. What we're trying to do is say, here's what's happening and what you should do about it, or how does this matter, right? We really try to be a context-driven blog for digital marketers instead of a something that's just, you know, here's what happened. And then we also use some tools and technologies. We use a software platform called Inbound Writer, which helps us pick topics based on our backward-looking and forward-predictive Google organic search. So we've got a good sense of what will work on our blog before it's written, which is very handy. We also, including using, we have another piece of technology called Atomic Reach, and we actually have our contributors write their guest posts in Atomic Reach, which provides them a 0 to 100 score on how appropriate what they've written is for our audiences. It's based on our personas, and that software gives them a sense of this is too advanced, not advanced enough, that kind of thing.
All right, so you have three people drooling in the room now. So when you...
Especially that Atomic Reach.
Yeah, so let's talk about that for a sec. Is that like beyond the reach of a like small business that's maybe not doing, you know, more than $1 million in revenue? Or is that, I mean, we don't have to talk about actual pricing, but I mean, is that something that's like just an enormous cost type of tool?
No, it's not super expensive. I mean, it's not, you know, it's not Hootsuite, right? It's not $5 a month or something. I don't remember exactly what it would be for a small business, but it's not outrageous by any stretch of the imagination. But I would look at it, it's not so much about the price. It's about how much content do you create and is it worth using that kind of technology? You know, if you're going to do two blog posts a week, it's like, it may not be worth it. But if you're, you know, if you're really building out a robust content engine, it's absolutely worth it.
So you create a tremendous amount of content, even though you're down to one blog post a week. I mean, with the J Today, I think that's 3-4 times a week, if I remember right, the three minute daily.
Yeah, and I said I write one blog post a week, and that's only partially true, as are most of the things that I say.
Okay, now we're going to start taking better notes.
So I write one blog post a week on Tuesdays, which is, you know, from scratch, here's what I think about whatever I think. And then I also write a post on Wednesday, which is based on a previous week's J Today video.
Right.
And then we have a post on Monday, which is the post summary of the Social Pros podcast that I host. So while I only really write from blank sheet of paper, one blog post a week, there's three posts a week that I'm essentially responsible for.
And then
or create the raw materials for.
And then you create, like I'm looking at Utility, which I have in front of me, which I want to talk about, which is a fantastic book. And you're working on a new book, which I hope we'll talk about in a few minutes. But and then you're a busy consultant. Obviously, you're speaking for events. You're working with clients. How do you manage to create that much content? So today is one thing, but there was a time when you were writing four blog posts a week from scratch, if I heard you right. I mean, what is it that, how did you get started to you know, become that kind of content generator?
You have to understand that at some level, making yourself into a media company, whether you're truly a media company like we are now, where we sell sponsorships and things like that, or you're a media company just because it helps perpetuate your own business, whether it's inbound leads or what have you, you have to understand that that is an investment that pays off geometrically over time. And it's an investment in your own exposure, but it does take a lot of time. The biggest tip I can give people who are thinking about doing more content is to understand that all media companies are built on perspiration, not inspiration. The biggest problem that people find is that they say, well, I'm going to write a blog post or do a video or send up a smoke signal or whatever when I feel like I have something interesting to say. And that, my friends, is the kiss of death.
Right.
If that is how you think about content, you will never be good at this. It has to be, look, I am going to make a video 3 times a week, period, and I will find out something interesting to say at that point. You start with a schedule and fill the schedule, as opposed to starting with something interesting and then hope to schedule it at some point. You just have to say, look, it's not like Sports Illustrated says, hey, it's kind of a slow news week because it's in between the playoffs. We're just not going to give you a magazine. Right? They're still going to send you a magazine, right? It's the same approach.
Well, my question is, because the focus now is so much on quality over quantity, right? That's something I'm hearing quite often. But it seems like to be successful, you also need to have quantity. So how do you determine, especially when starting out, how often to write and how much focus or time to put in each one of these episodes? Or not episodes, posts.
Well, whatever kind of content, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I think what you want to, how we do it in our organization, how we advise clients, is to think of it as 2 interlaced programs. So when you think about quantity versus quality, we prefer to think of that as bricks versus feathers. There's 2 types of content. You've got bricks content, which is heftier, the way a brick would be, and it's higher production value, and it's the kind of content that somebody would print or share or keep or bookmark, or it's just something that's got shelf life, right? And then you have feathers, which are smaller, more disposable pieces of content that are important but don't have the same kind of heft, production value, etc. So a brick is something like a SlideShare presentation or a video series or a podcast or an ebook, a webinar. Feathers are things like a single blog post or appearing on somebody else's podcast or Facebook posts or things of that nature. So what we think about are bricks throughout the year as sort of tent poles, and then feathers that surround those bricks and kind of fill the gaps in between.
Now, the bricks take a lot of work, and you guys are obviously scaled up at this. How many bricks do you do in a year? I'm just curious.
We don't have a set number, although we probably should. It's a little bit tricky because we have 3, 4, soon to be 5 podcasts of our own that we produce, each of which are bricks. So if you think about podcast, we have 5 podcasts, so that's 5 bricks that happen on a near weekly basis. And then we do increasingly more and more SlideShare, which we like a lot, and it works great. I would say our cadence for this year is 1 pretty solid SlideShare presentation a month. We've got somebody on our team now who's really good at it, and she's making a lot of those new SlideShare bricks. But even at that, we are always looking to reconfigure, repackage, what we call atomize the content. So the things that we do so often are not reinventing the wheel. It's just making new wheels that you already own. So one of the things that we do is we'll take a very successful blog post that I've written. Typically, it's one that I wrote. And then we'll take that blog post and turn it into a SlideShare. Put graphics against it, roll it out that way. So now you're taking something you already own and making something else out of it. The Jay Today video is, I think, probably the best example of that. I just turn on my iPhone. I talk into my iPhone for 3 minutes. I upload it. Our team on the back edits it. We take that video, and it becomes 9 pieces of content. Right? It goes on YouTube. It goes on Facebook. It goes on company Facebook. It goes on iTunes as an audio podcast. It goes on iTunes as a video podcast. We transcribe it, and we make it a blog post on our site. We transcribe it, change the headline and the intro, and put it as a column on Medium. We change the headline again and a little bit of other assets. We put it as a column on LinkedIn. And then it also shows up as a featured item in our daily email newsletter.
Holy crap, Jay.
So one three-minute video, right? 1 3-minute video, which takes me 4 minutes to produce. It literally takes me 4 minutes. I don't make notes. I don't do a storyboard. I turn on the camera and talk into it. It takes me 4 minutes to produce it. It becomes 9 pieces of content. That's the secret. Because if I had to make 9 separate pieces of content, there's no way I could do it.
Wow.
We're all just letting that settle in.
I'm a little bit stunned by that, the degree by which you can slice that up and distribute it around on the various channels. That's kind of stunning and brilliant.
Yeah, changing the title. How do you deal with Google's duplicate content thing if the body of the content is the same?
Yeah, we've talked to those guys about it, and they're much smarter than we think. I mean, they always know where something was published first. So because it's a video initially too, kind of it's a little tricky to think about where it was, you know, first appeared in print, quote unquote. And so that's one of the reasons why we changed the title and we changed some other pieces of it as well to sort of make sure that there's no confusion. But from our perspective, it doesn't really matter. Like, of course, we'd like people to come to our blog, but people are coming to our blog anyway. And if they find this piece of content on LinkedIn or they find this piece of content on Medium, that's fine too. It's just probably reaching people who don't know us yet, and there's nothing wrong with that.
So
certainly, we've seen no penalty effect, quote unquote.
Yeah, I mean your organic traffic isn't suffering, for example, coming from Google.
No, I mean, in fact, you know, the blog has been, we've been doing it 6.5 years now, and our organic traffic is 71% of our total traffic.
And how does that make you feel, given the amount of energy that goes into social and email and the other things that you're doing to distribute that content?
Well, it certainly makes you realize that as important as social is, it's probably more important for things other than driving traffic. It certainly drives traffic. I mean, it's the third greatest contributor to our traffic overall, but in comparison to organic search, it's quite small.
Okay, so
but there are other reasons to do that. I mean, there are other, you know, sure. Social pays off in other ways other than just traffic.
Yeah, the visibility and the name recognition, the branding, the other the awareness, all of that other good stuff. So let's talk about why all of that's true. So you're creating enormous amounts of content, and I think you've dropped some bombs on us here today. So we're all sort of, you know, dazed and confused, like thinking, "Wow, we're just not producing enough content." But you are a media company, so obviously, as a media company, this is your business. But what I heard you say earlier is you're advising everyone to begin thinking about their business as a media company, which brings me to utility. So the fundamental premise, if I could just boil it down, of utility is making your business, at least the content that your business produces, incredibly useful. So obviously, maybe it isn't obvious. How does that strategy apply in the Convince and Convert world? And then let's dive into the book a little bit.
Well, in the Convince and Convert world, I think where it applies is that we take everything we know, everything that we're paid a lot of money to know for big companies, and we give it away one bite at a time.
And
whether it's blog posts or podcasts or videos or anything else, our goal is to tell you everything we know, one bite at a time. And we're not scared about that. Like a lot of people who are in professional services get scared. They say, well, I can't tell you what I know because then you won't have to hire me, or you won't want to hire me, or then I've given away the quote unquote secret sauce, which is ridiculous because a list of ingredients doesn't make somebody a chef. It's not the same thing, right? Just because I wrote a blog post about how to do a social media strategy doesn't mean that you can take that blog post and do a social media strategy the same way that I would do it. And if you think you can, then you're probably not a client I wanted anyway.
Brilliant. And so your strategy for making useful content attracts the people who may want to do it themselves. You mentioned one of your buyer personas one of your personas, at least on the blog itself, is, for example, small business owners. My suspicion is that a typical small business isn't likely your best client as a consultant. Am I right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And so we want to give them those resources so that they can do it themselves. And maybe at some point their company will grow to the point that they want help from us or from somebody else. And that's fine. And in the interim, those are people who come see me speak and buy books and listen to the podcast and come back to the site, which drives our traffic, which allows us to charge more for sponsorships. You know, there's other value. There's a lot of value in people other than just as clients. In fact, you know, we're a small consultancy. There's only 11 of us. And so we don't want that many clients. We can't handle that many clients. And so we're delighted to have a much, much, much larger pool of fans who drive value in other ways.
So you gave the example in the book of the Geek Squad, which was producing short video clips that taught people how to do the very things that they, as geeks in Best Buy stores, were doing for customers. And obviously that is challenging for some people for the same reasons you articulated earlier. I'm closing the information gap by giving away my expertise. Let's talk about that strategy. How do small businesses kind of overcome their fear that they're giving away their value?
Well, I think the biggest piece of that is to understand that your value is probably not actually unique, right? People think they've got some sort of proprietary process or whatever, and I've been a consultant for 25 years, and that's almost never true. Your process is exactly the same as your competitor's process. You just have a different name for it. So I think my first piece of advice is get over yourself. And my second piece of advice is, look, if it's really that awesome, everybody who needs to know about it already knows about it, right? Has anybody ever worked for you and now works for your competitor? Yes. Well, so your proprietary process is no longer proprietary. Has anybody ever been a client of yours and is now a client of your competitors and vice versa? Yes. Your proprietary process is no longer proprietary. So this idea that somehow you're sitting on like the Coke formula is really not true in the real world.
Why do you think we believe that way? I'm just curious. What it is in human
nature
that
it makes us feel like we have a reason to be in business, right? I mean, look, we're running a very successful company here. I've been in this business for a long, long time, and I still feel every day when I wake up like I'm faking it, right? Like,
you know, we're recording this, you know.
Who am I to tell these giant companies how to do their stuff? I still feel that way every single day. And so I remember very clearly being a very small business. And if you convince yourself that you have something special, it gives you the confidence to walk into somebody's room and say, I've got something special, pay me for it. But what I've discovered over a long period of time is that it's not about having something special. It's about being able to drive results, right? It's not about uniqueness. It's about effectiveness. And it took me a long, long time to figure that out.
Execution, right? Executing what you actually say you can do.
Absolutely. I did a J Today video a couple days ago about my friend Jason Falls, who some of you may know. He's a digital marketing expert and author and speaker. And he wrote a blog post, which I found irksome and hilarious, that my new book, which is called Hug Your Haters, which I'm writing now, is all about how to handle customer service in this postmodern social digital mobile world.
Hug your
haters.
There's
a ton of customer service. Yeah, there's a ton of customer service books, right? But there's none about customer service in the modern age. Mm-hmm. And so he wrote this blog post that said, hey, I'm sure this book is going to be really good. Jay writes good books, but you know, I think that topic's played out. And I answered back in the comments. I said, well, I know we're in a fast paced world, but to say a book is played out before it's been written is amazing. That's truly, truly remarkable. And the second thing is I said, you know, when, and this is my question in the video, is when is a topic quote unquote played out? Is it played out when it's been discussed, or is it played out when it's been fully implemented? Because by my way of thinking, you could look at Christianity and say that's not played out because we're more than 2,000 years into a very long implementation phase, and we're still not really there yet, right? So that's what I think about, right? And you nailed it. It's execution. And if you can help people execute, you will always have a job.
Wow. Okay. So, and that brings us to the point that you made in the book with Best Buy, or actually I think the Best Buy executive or Geek Squad executive made the point that, you know, people get over their skis and that's when they come see us. So fine, they let them try, but they're not actually going to be successful executing. So Jay, is there a secret sauce that Convince and Convert has for execution?
I don't think there's a secret sauce, but I do think we look at digital marketing and social and content a little differently than other consulting firms, in that everybody on our team has been in business, has been in marketing for quite a while. We don't have a lot of young, you know, really young people on staff, and that's neither a good thing or a bad thing. It's just a different thing. And the result of that is we don't really care about social media and content marketing. I mean, we're not in love with the technology. We're not enamored by it. We're about business. and business results. And we just happen to use social media and content marketing at this point to drive those business results, right? In previous chapters of my life, I could have consulted with you on email or SEO or landing page optimization or display ads or radio or magazines or outdoor, right? Or direct mail. I was a direct mail specialist early in my career for John McCain. So
fascinating.
I don't
Arizona. There we go. Yeah.
We very much live by a tactically agnostic creed. And I think that makes us effective consultants because we're not trying to sell you a piece of technology. We're trying to drive solutions that sometimes need technology to get there.
I like the tactically agnostic approach because that sets you up for success in today's world, because really none of us could be married to any tactics today. Am I right?
You can be married to tactics. You can get to the point where something is working repeatedly and you're like, you know what? This is a major, major, I mean, there's people I know who just absolutely love Facebook ads and drive all kinds of fantastic ROI with Facebook ads. And they would be hard pressed to stop doing that. So I'm okay with being married to technology or a particular tactic. If you've tested all other alternatives and found that that's the best one and you've got it figured out, you've got it dialed in, that's okay. But what I find usually happens, and by usually I mean like 98.5% of the time, is that people fall in love with the technology for reasons that aren't necessarily bottom line driven. Mm-hmm. They just like it, right? Or they tried it for 2 minutes and like, oh, this is cool, I'm just going to do this, right? They haven't fully investigated their alternatives.
Right. And then even though when you have, if you do get married to a technology, it's not exactly a lifelong marriage here, because even Facebook ads, we know, I mean, I was just thinking the other day about MySpace, and MySpace was, you know, this incredible, huge platform. Everybody was on it until they found Facebook, and the next day MySpace was a question mark. What was that? You know, and so Facebook had probably better legs than MySpace over time, but there's no expectation that 10 years from now that it'll be the dominant technology platform out there as far as, you know, this sort of familial communications that goes on with it and the allowance for those targeted Facebook ads, which really are effective. We use it with clients and we use it with political clients too, and they're very, very effective right now. But doesn't it seem like that the eyes always have to be open for the next technology that you can also fit within your execution capabilities?
Yeah, it provides a lot of job security for people like us who have to wade through what's real and what's fictitious in terms of new technology. But I also feel like in many cases, unless you're a forward-looking sort of younger skewing B2C brand, I also feel like many companies adopt new stuff faster than they need to. There's no real merits in being somewhere that your customers aren't yet. Mm-hmm. And so the popular press and the marketing press tends to get people excited about tools and technologies that aren't necessarily right for your customer audience.
Well, that drives clicks, you know? The new, the exciting.
To the media properties.
Yeah, they got to sell papers.
It's beneficial to them, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely.
I'm just curious, where do you think all this is going? Because I just, in my mind, I look at content and I read so much of it. I spend so much time and after a while, I'm like, I'm tired of just reading this content and it's all amazing, but I can't keep up with it. And it seems like the value of it, of investing in this for your business over time is going to become incrementally less. And I know that the idea is that it becomes incrementally more over time. But where do you think all this is going? Is there going to become a content overload period in time where, you know, just writing blog posts is not going to be as effective, do you think?
Well, certainly my friend Mark Schaefer predicts that will be the case. He has a new book out called The Content Code, which talks about the amazing increase in content and how to survive this notion of content shock, where when everybody's creating content, how can you possibly succeed? And there's no question that it has gotten harder to break through. But I always look at it as that's just natural, right? I mean, there was a point in time where it was really easy to succeed with paid search. And then everybody started doing paid search and it got harder, right? There was a time when it was really easy to succeed with Facebook ads, and then everybody started doing Facebook ads and it got harder. So that's a natural, I mean, email is the same way. There was a time when it was really easy to succeed with email marketing, and then everybody started to send email and it got harder. So competition and it being more difficult to break through is just a natural cycle in business. And there's lots of specific ways to ensure or help ensure that you break through, but there's really only one thing you need to know, which is that relevancy always wins. Mm-hmm. If you want to create content that succeeds, create content that is relevant, because every single marketer in the world, including me, tells themselves the same lie. And that lie is that their customers and prospective customers are too busy, that they're surrounded by too much content, that they can't possibly pay attention to us because they're overloaded. And that's not true. It's simply not true, because when you send somebody or give somebody or direct somebody to something that is truly relevant, that gives them the information that they need at that moment in time, it's remarkable how time is magically created. It just magically appears. So if you want to be better at content, focus your content on a particular type of, you know, audience and give them the best possible solution for whatever it is that they need. You know, get sharper with your content. It's not necessarily about production value and you know, more polish and things like that. It's just about more relevance.
Wow. So you early in our conversation talked about the personas that you developed for Convince and Convert, and just kind of to close the loop on that, I'm a small business owner. I'm listening today and I'm thinking, okay, I want to be as relevant as I can possibly be to the perfect customers, the people I'm trying to attract. What sort of process would you ask or challenge a business owner to go through to sort of develop a set of personas or maybe a single persona like the ones that you articulated earlier?
I would do three things. First, I would, assuming that you've got some content already, right? You already have a website, a blog, et cetera. I would do some very deep mining of your historical patterns and say, what do we have now that is disproportionately successful and why do we think that's so? So use your existing analytics to help drive your understanding of your value. That's the first thing I would do. The second thing I would do is use one of the kind of excellent kind of persona tools out there. There's some great free or nearly free persona building software tools out there that I would absolutely look into. The one I like the best is upcloseandpersona.com.
Okay.
Which I really like. It's great. And to sort of help you guide the persona process. But the third thing, and probably the most important thing, is to actually sit down and have real conversations with your customers and prospective customers. You know, I'm an old guy now. I've been doing this a long time. I mean, I had a typewriter in college. So I have learned how to do all this stuff. I didn't come out of the womb as like social media geek boy.
Wait a minute. You're in your mid-40s, am I right?
Yes, that is correct.
Okay, all right. Just to clarify, because we actually do have an old guy in the room.
Yeah, I remember typewriters too well. I actually started in journalism with a typewriter. So.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. I remember. So one of the things we've lost in the sort of span of my career is that conversations with customers ethos. When I was first starting out, we had conversations with customers all the time because we had no other option, right? And now marketers are surrounded by data, but starved for insights. We've got more data than we've ever had. We got more data and spreadsheets and APIs and reports and press a button and here it is. But every time you look at that report, whether it's Google Analytics or a sales report or a spreadsheet of any kind, you are by definition treating your customer as a number. And that is a problem. So we used to get up out of our chair in our office all the time and do focus groups and customer calls and go visit with customers to really understand them. And we don't do that now because it's a pain in the ass. It's easier to go on your browser and click print. And that makes you a lazy marketer and a not very smart marketer. So if I could tell people, especially small business owners listening, to do one thing before you get into content, It's make sure you go out and have a bunch of conversations with your customers, because that's how the really interesting utilities come to pass.
Along those lines, Jay, when I sit down to write something, and I, keep in mind, I'm not a very good writer, so I don't do it very often, but I need to do it more so I become a better writer. But my, in my mind, I've got like five different people that I'm trying to write to. And I'm tempted to write to that one person that I know needs the help the most. And, but then I feel like, well, I have to include these other people that in their scenario too. So when you write, do you have one person in mind? Like, is there somebody that you picture as you're writing an article?
That is a very, very good technique. In fact, the best way to do that, I find, is to actually, you know, name your personas and have headshots for them, and then print those personas out and put them on your desk or as a poster near your laptop, that kind of thing, to drive that humanity. I don't personally do that, I think, because I've been writing for so long and so much that I just sort of naturally kind of have a sense for my style. But it is a very, very good idea. We just finished a consulting project like that with some with a corporation who wanted their blog to be sharper and more relevant. And we went through that whole process, you know, made the personas, printed them out, then trained all of their bloggers about how to write for each persona. It's a really good way to go about it.
I learned that technique in radio when I first started as a DJ. They handed me a photograph and said, that's who you're talking to, and just talk to one person. And the right from me to you concept is something we've translated into, you know, all digital forms of marketing, really, from email, social, doesn't matter. We're not talking to a group. I'm talking to one person.
I love that.
I'm curious, Jay, what was digital marketing back in 93 when you started? I don't even have a context. You mentioned context and relevancy. I don't even understand.
Were you
what
even
was going
born on. In 93?
Yes,
Josh?
I was born.
Okay, I'm just trying
like
to make sure.
Yeah. Seven, yeah. Probably.
But I didn't know.
Literally.
Where was digital marketing in this online world at that time?
I mean, at that point, it was, I mean, I spent the first, I mean, 3 to 4 years of my career, maybe five. My internet career, convincing companies that they needed a website because there was no web. I mean, I started doing this before we even had a browser. So there was no website sort of industry at all. In fact, my former partner invented virtual web hosting kind of accidentally. And we would go into meetings with big companies and say, well, you know, you should build this website so that people know, you know, what your products and services are and stuff. They're like, well, why would I want people to know about my products and services at night or on Saturday? We're closed. And we're like, well, yeah, but because you're closed, people could still understand what your products and services are. But we would just rather have them call, because then we can talk to them on the phone and sell them the stuff. Well, yeah, but some people don't want to call. It's easier for them to just look it up. Like, well, what are they going to use to do that? Well, they're going to use a computer. Well, why would they do that? I mean, so literally it was like that kind of conversation over and over for 5 years. So there was no digital marketing. It was just at that point, digital presence building. It was sharecropping. And that was all it was for a long time.
I think that's the cycle of technology or the waves of technology, because I mean, I remember it was like 97 or 98 and I actually got the domain name for my own name, because I thought that'd be cool to have. And at the newspaper I was working at then, for 2 years, I tried to tell them, we need a website for the newspaper. And it was constantly poo-pooed. Why would we want to do that? For one thing, we're not going to give away stuff for free. And nobody's on the web anyway. It doesn't matter. It's not important. It's just for email now. You know, and there was that whole learning process there. But now if you take younger people like Josh's generation, but even older, that whole concept is almost like an absurdity to them. However, the principle that comes from that is that 15 years from now, what we're doing right now, what's cutting edge and what everybody is doing, might look like an absurdity. So we need to be flexible in moving forward.
In more ways than one, actually.
In more ways than one, we need to be flexible.
Well, I mean,
forward
think about what happens, was it 2 weeks from now, 2.5 weeks, when Google's going to massively change their search results based on how mobile-friendly your website is?
Yeah.
I mean, that's a That's a big deal.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the rumblings of that are beginning. So, hey, in the few minutes we have left, first of all, I want to just highly recommend the book Utility, because it's spelled Y-O-U, Utility, by the way, just in case you're listening via audio today and not able to figure that out. It's Utility. Fantastic book. You have written other books as well, The Now Revolution, and some others. I love the title, Hug Your Haters.
That's good.
So are you dealing with trolls? Is that the...
No, I mean, we'll touch on trolls a little bit, but it really is about all complaints, right? The Hug Your Haters recipe is to answer every complaint in every channel every time. And almost no business in the world does that. And so we're going to talk about why that's important, how to do that, tons of great stories and case studies and advice.
All right, we're going to look forward to that book. In the meantime, I highly recommend that you go grab a copy of Utility, because not only, Jay, do you do a great job of sort of articulating the mindsets that are necessary to become useful as a business, but you also do a deep dive into how to do it. So thank you for the book, because it is, I mean, you didn't give me a copy, I bought it, but I'm still thanking you for writing it.
Well, thank you for buying one. I appreciate that.
You're welcome.
I've made $1.50.
Oh wow, hey, that's great. That's great. Well, I'm glad this conversation could be so valuable. So I have I want to ask one more question for you as we wind up. You grew up in Arizona, or spent most of your life in Arizona. Am I right?
That is true.
And what on earth? First of all, two parts to this question. What on earth caused you to go north, and how did you choose where you are now?
So I'd been in Arizona almost my whole life, and my wife and I decided that we wanted to move our kids to a college town. I just like college towns. You get a high cultural level without a lot of hassle. It's easy living. You got smart neighbors, all those kind of things. And so we went online and we made a list of things we cared about. So, you know, cost of living, close to an airport because I travel so much, access to healthcare, schools, those kind of things. And we used some websites where you could put in those attributes using sliders and things like that. They would recommend cities to you. So I kept doing that. We wanted to be in the Midwest because I travel so much. It's nice to be in the middle because I can get to both coasts up, down, sideways pretty easily. So we said Midwestern college town, these attributes, and these websites kept saying Bloomington, Indiana, Bloomington, Indiana. And I'm like, well, I mean, I've been in the internet for a long time. Who am I to argue with a relational database? So I'd never been to Bloomington, but I said, well, all these websites keep saying Bloomington. So I convinced her to go with me, and we jumped on a plane and came out here, spent a few days with a realtor and kind of rolling around. I said, yeah, I really like it. And moved back to Arizona and sold our stuff and jumped in the car and came out here. So we've been here almost 5 years in Bloomington, and it's been fantastic. It's a great place. It's where Indiana University is located. Very cool, classic Midwestern college town, you know, 100,000 people, that kind of thing. It's worked out great.
I'm guessing that when you were there with the realtor and looking at the community and all, it wasn't in January.
It was May.
Yeah, there you go. May, actually. Beautiful. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's true. The weather here was not, you know, first, second, or third on the list. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here. But right. One of the reasons we picked Bloomington, actually, not the reason, but one of the reasons, is that the weather here is better, and I'm throwing up the air quotes right now for those of you listening at home. It is better than Ann Arbor. Yes. Or Madison, which are both also, you know, also classic Midwestern college towns in Michigan and Wisconsin, respectively, that are far enough north that it is a little harsher winter up there than it is here. So it's not great here. But
I'm very curious now because I'm a Michigan State Spartan. Did Lansing not show up in your search there? Ann Arbor did, and Lansing didn't.
Lansing did not bubble up. I don't know.
I mean, it's even the capital too. Although maybe that's a drawback.
Yeah, maybe.
Okay.
Well, is there an airport close by? Because that would kind of rule it out.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm just wondering because, you know.
It's the capital and it's got right. Michigan State, which is actually larger than Michigan. But okay.
Oh, boy.
Enough
well,
of that.
Yep. So what I love about the story, though, is that you used technology.
Uh-huh. That's great.
and someone developed an incredibly useful bit of technology, apparently.
Yeah. Do you work?
Yeah. Well, the joke was somebody said to me, Hey, was that built by the Bloomington Convention and Visitors Bureau as a deep cover marketing ploy? And I'm like, I don't think so, but that would be brilliant, actually. So
maybe the Sarasota Chamber of Commerce here needs to pay attention to that.
Yeah. What about your team? Is your team for Convince and Convert there in Indiana?
No, no,
or are
virtual,
you remote?
All virtual. So everybody works from home. We're all over the country. We've got some in New York, Portland, LA, Phoenix, Ohio, and Indiana. So we're in all time zones.
A distributed team. So Jay, with that, thank you again for being here today. How can people find you? What's the best way to follow you and keep up?
ConvinceAndConvert.com is probably the best place to go because you can get the blog and the email and the podcast and all those things. But if you want to find me, just Google Jay Bear. I can't.
Well, that's true. And I highly recommend the One Thing email, which is a blast every day, if you'll pardon the pun. And I enjoy all of the content because it's just nicely put together in an easy to digest format. And once again, I am truly grateful for you taking the time. All of us have enjoyed this very much. We've all got a lot of notes.
We have. Matter of fact, we always look to pull one good strong quote clip from the podcast to put at the beginning, and this one is so chock full we might not be able to actually choose just one. I don't know what we'll do. You've created a great conundrum for us, Jay, and we appreciate it.
I'm glad to do it. I'm glad to hear it. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. And we're delighted that you were listening today. We hope you'll leave us a review on iTunes. Make sure you subscribe. Check out all the show archives and all the other good stuff. And don't forget to tune in next week for another episode of Grow the Dream.
Thanks for listening to the Grow the Dream Show. We invite you to subscribe and leave us a review on iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app. Get connected to our growing community, add your comments, ask questions, and listen to the archives on the web at growthedream.com/show.